Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is Morteza, your host from Critical Theory Channel. And today we are honored to have Dr. Max Haven with us. He's an associate professor of English at Lakehead University in Canada. He's also a Canada researcher in Radical Imagination. He's the author of several books, including Revenge Capitalism, The Ghosts of Empire, The Demons of Capital, and The Settling of Unpayable Debts, published in 2020, and also Art After Money, Money After Art, Creative Strategies Against Financialization, published in 2018. His most recent book is Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire, which was published in 2022 by Pluto Press. Max, welcome to New Books Network.
Thanks so much.
It's customary to ask our guests to introduce themselves, tell us how they got interested in their field of studies. In your case, it's English and also, I guess, a bit of history because you've written this book about palm oil, The Grease of Empire. Can you introduce yourself briefly and then tell us how the book came about?
Sure. I think it's important maybe to mention that I came to academia from a history in grassroots social activism in Canada and anti-capitalist activism. And I came to academe as a place to try and answer some very difficult questions I had for myself about the fate of those forms of activism in the early 2000s. And somehow along the way, I fell into the field of cultural studies and critical theory and did my PhD on that. And then I have a relatively restless anti-disciplinary imagination, which has good sides and bad sides. And that's led me through a whole range of different projects. So in the past, I've done some social movement sociology. I've done some work sort of theorizing the imagination. As you mentioned in your introduction, I've done some work on art and artists and art markets. And then most recently, before this book on palm oil, a book on the cultural politics of revenge. And this project, Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire, really came out of several years of teaching on the subject, which gave me a sort of broad, somewhat eclectic approach to a topic. And, you know, that goes in certain directions.
I guess I could tell by looking at the title of the books, right? Revenge Capitalism, Art After Money, Money After Art. And I'm just curious, can you tell us about the research center? Because you're also a researcher in Radical Imagination. Is that an institute at Lakehead University?
Yes. So I'm the beneficiary of a program established by the Canadian government about 30 years now. Ago now called the Canada Research Chairs Program. And when you are appointed a research chair, as I am at Lakehead University, which is in a quite remote location in Northwest Ontario in Canada, you're asked to establish a lab. And under those auspices, I established the Reimagining Value Action Lab, which is a workshop for the radical imagination, social justice, and decolonization. So we do primarily a lot of public events, a lot of public education around a whole variety of issues, some activist training, some film screenings, some theory workshops, some print workshops, and then we also organize events both in Thunder Bay, where we're located physically, but also around the world. And those have included scholarly and artistic walking tours of different financial districts, organizing workshops and conferences. And right now we're developing a side of that lab that is developing board games to enliven the radical imagination and teach critical ideas.
Fascinating. So before reading your book, I knew that, you know, palm oil was ubiquitous. It was everywhere. But, you know, having read the book, I even feel more guilty. So can you talk about this ubiquity of palm oil in our daily lives? How did it become a main part of our life? Because in any commodity we consume, whether we use it or we eat it, it is there.
Yes. Well, by many estimates, including estimates that are propounded by the palm oil industry itself, palm oil can be found in 50% of products that you might buy at a supermarket. And we're familiar with palm oil in processed foods, perhaps most notoriously in the delectable chocolate hazelnut spread Nutella and other processed foods of that nature. But it can also be found in pre-fried foods, in foods like ramen noodles, which play a large role in my book, and often as ingredients in a whole variety of other foods, used in small traces as preservatives or coagulants or lubrication in various ways. But beyond just the food, and of course, it's also found in many, many edible oils like margarines and lard replacers, fat replacers, vegetable oils. But then it's also found in a huge number of cosmetics, many, many cleaning products, most shampoos and soaps. And beyond that, it's also an ingredient in many different products that seem to have nothing to do with palm oil. So it's sometimes used in inks and dyes and waxes and all sorts of other things you might find in a vast diversity of other products. So ultimately, the estimate is that it's in 50% of supermarket products, but it's almost impossible to quantify. And the reason it's there is quite simply because it's cheap. My book is a short, somewhat provocative introduction to palm oil and a kind of unpacking of its many imperial characteristics. But the best history book on palm oil is Jonathan Robbins' Oil Palm, A Global History. And in that book, he makes, I think, the very astute points that palm oil doesn't need to exist for global capitalism as we know it to exist in all its commodities. And yet it offers almost, you know, a vast number of different production processes, a cheap ingredient or a cheap lubricant, such that it can render many products much cheaper to manufacture than if you had to use other products. And of course, as, you know, bears mentioning, that cheapness is born on the backs of workers and the environment around the world.
So the only justification is just profit, in a way, for it to exist.
Yeah, it is a miraculous product, I have to say. You know, it is, I think Michael Taussig in his book on palm oil thinks about it as the philosopher's stone. It's a product that can be turned into a vast number of end commodities. And because it's so cheap and ubiquitous, it has led to a great deal of experimentation and development of, you know, highly refined modern palm oil into a variety of products. And so to give it its due, it is extremely versatile. It's unlike most vegetable oils. It's very high in saturated fats. It has a very unique chemical composition. It's very easy to break down in the chemical process, so that it can be turned into a vast diversity of products. So it does have some very unique characteristics, but its chief characteristic within capitalism is its cheapness.
Yeah, we'll talk about that further down the interview, because you have the expression "fat of the poor" and the economic consequences of using that on the global south. That's something we'll talk about soon. But can you tell us where did it first come from? Because in your book, you also mentioned that it had been used by in West Africa for centuries, but they use it more sustainably than us. So can you tell us where it first came from, or how it was used first in Africa?
Yeah, well, there are a number of palm trees that can be, their fruits can be cultivated for oil. But the type of oil palm that we today gain the huge amount of palm oil we use from is very specific, and it has its origins in West Africa. And there, it's been cultivated and harvested for millennia by people in a vast diversity of cultures there, and used for a vast diversity of purposes. So red or virgin palm oil is still a huge staple of the diet in West Africa, and very beloved by both people within those countries and their global diasporas. And in addition to being a very important part of the diet, it's also used in commodities, or sorry, in cosmetics, sorry, in cleaning products and soaps. And it also has many different cultural resonances and spiritual resonances as well. So it's a very, very important part of West African culture. And one of the risks about writing a book on palm oil and studying palm oil in its contemporary expression is to not add further stigmatization to these more indigenous, sustainable West African uses of palm oil, which have, you know, been stigmatized over the centuries and up to today, but instead to separate out those more traditional uses and experiments with palm oil from the way it's become a global commodity of empire.
And when was it first discovered by Europeans, and how was it brought to Europe?
Well, Europeans had known about palm oil since as early as the 1600s, perhaps earlier, and they never really developed much of a taste for it or thought of many uses for it. It really became a commodity that began to be exported to Europe after the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade in the early 19th century. And it really had its origins in the fact that the West African merchants of Liverpool and Plymouth and other, especially British cities, needed to find a new product to trade, to maintain their commerce on the West African shore as the trade in human flesh became more difficult for them. And palm oil presented one of several commodities, including ivory and later rubber, that was very appealing to them. And as cheap palm oil began to make its way into Europe, Europeans developed a whole variety of uses for it, especially as the Industrial Revolution proceeded and as it was possible to manufacture things like soap and candles at an industrial scale. And also as the machines of the Industrial Revolution needed to be greased, and palm oil, especially as it became cheaper and cheaper thanks to European imperialism in West Africa, became a very sought after source for those kind of lubricants and ingredients.
And in the book, you talk about, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Edo Kingdom, so the destruction of Edo Kingdom, and how it sort of illustrates that palm oil was central to European colonial expansion. Can you talk about that episode as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whole global history of palm oil, the invasion and destruction of the Edo Kingdom, which is sometimes also known as the Benin Empire, is relatively minor, but it's very significant for the story that I want to tell. And just a quick detour to explain where this particular book came from. In 2011, I was hired to teach at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. And not being an art historian, I was hired in order to teach fine art students about capitalism and the histories of capitalism. And I kept looking for examples that would allow them to understand how deeply entangled capitalism is with our everyday lives, but also with histories of imperialism, colonialism, the race-making project of those systems. And I came across the story of what have come to be known as the Benin Bronzes, which are a set of really incredible brass statues, ivory statues, and wall ornaments that were seized from the Edo Kingdom when the British Empire invaded in 1897. And these allowed me to talk about the way that artifacts from different civilizations appear in Western museums, And the way that they change contexts when they're taken from their original location in the places of their origin, in this case, West Africa and the territories that are now known as Nigeria, and then taken to, for instance, the British Museum, which still houses the world's largest collection of the bronzes, they no longer appear as they did in their original context as spiritual artifacts or artifacts that tell the story of a kingdom. They become evidence, essentially, of Western supremacy and of white supremacy and of the power of empire, and they're put on display for that reason. So I was trying to explain this to students, and that's where I realized that the reason why the British Empire invaded the Edo Kingdom in 1897 was not actually to seize these artifacts. They hardly knew the artifacts existed, really. They were just booty of war. They, in fact, invaded the kingdom in order to seize its quite capacious palm oil production capacity. The kingdom was an empire and dominated lands around it and used palm oil as a major part of its economy, as well as its sort of spiritual and cultural economy as well. And so the British Empire, essentially, this was one of many ventures into the territories we now know as Nigeria, but also West Africa more broadly, following the Berlin Conference, where European powers carved up Africa into their various zones of influence, where they stepped in and either subjugated or destroyed an African kingdom in the name of, getting access to natural resources, and in this case, palm oil. And I should say not only natural resources, but also the labor power to process those natural resources into useful commodities.
And so anyway, palm oil is the legacy of an empire. And you just mentioned earlier the abolishment of slave trade and how the business with palm oil sort of took off after that in England. Can you talk about how the products in which palm oil was used were in a way featured as an ethical choice to use, and in which stereotypical, let's say, racial tropes and also tropes of white supremacy were manifested, like soap, for example?
Soap is one of the most famous examples, because soap in the 19th century was largely made up of either palm oil or olive oil. And palm oil throughout the 19th century got cheaper and cheaper, both as the labor in Africa was devalued and also as new transportation technologies made it simpler to refine the oil and transport it back to Europe. A number of other commodities that emerged were machine oils, which, were used to grease the machines of the Industrial Revolution, railways, also steamships, such as the steamship that brought the British soldiers up the river to the Edo Kingdom, and also candles. And also palm oil was quite essential in the 19th century and into the 20th century as part of manufacturing tinned cans that were important for packaging foods that could be sent on long ship voyages, and also bringing foods from across the empire back to the metropole for consumption there. And in each of those cases, new needs needed to be manufactured by the dawning age of industrial and consumer capitalism. So the ways in which people cleaned themselves transformed over the 19th century, so that soap went from being a luxury to a commodity that everyone needed to have. Lever company, which is the antecedent of today's Unilever, was really central to promoting these notions of cleanliness that orbited and were advertised in terms of white supremacy and duty to empire, specifically advertised to middle-class women as sort of their duty to preserve the hygiene of the white race and to ensure that they were doing their part to support king and country. This has been very well sort of documented and analyzed by Anne McClintock in her excellent and now quite classic book, Imperial Leather. But this was the case with other palm oil commodities as well. Price's Candles, which is a brand that's still sold today, in fact, advertised its product, which became largely made out of palm oil by the end of the 19th century, as a form of ethical consumerism. So European consumers, and particularly the middle classes, were exhorted to purchase Price's candles as a way of supporting what was presented as a beneficial and uplifting business in West Africa. West Africa, really, until the 20th century, and, you know, arguably still today within the racist European imagination, was presented, of course, as this sort of dark-hearted continent where all sorts of terrible things continued, including human sacrifice and the perpetuation of slavery. In fact, the British invaded the Edo Kingdom we were speaking about before, largely on the pretext that its ruling class practiced human sacrifice in some form. Price's candles advertised itself suggesting that the sort of the persuasive power of gentle commerce would convince the sort of inhabitants of the dark continent to give up their savage ways and adopt more beneficial forms of commerce and learn the value of hard work. There was this whole notion that Europeans, through their consumer choices, could do a kind of missionary work through consumer capitalism. And in the book, I argue that these kind of racist colonial tropes, though they've changed form, they persist to this day in a lot of the discourse around palm oil, both from the industry itself, which is increasingly suggesting that palm oil is a sustainable, eco-friendly, and worker-friendly commodity, which it is in fact not, but also in many of the groups that are opposed to palm oil, including large environmental NGOs who have quite robust and expansive advertising and marketing campaigns against palm oil, but still tend to approach the European or the North American normatively white consumer as a beneficial actor who essentially votes for human rights through their pocketbook.
And I think even with the consumption of tea in England in the 19th century, there were more or less a similar story as well. It was marketed as something British, and it was marketed as something that would benefit people of other nations if you consume it. But let's talk about industrial. You've talked about industrial revolution, but something that doesn't really get much talked about is the role of palm oil in militarism and in weapon industry, and that's something I've also approached in the book. Especially the use of palm oil in the Second World War. Can you talk a little about that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting things about studying this book was really trying to locate palm oil not only within the commercial and capitalist sides of the empire, but also the military sides of the empire as well. So in the late 19th century, before there were widely available mineral oils and oils derived from petroleum, highly refined coal products, European empires were really struggling with one another to find a universal gun oil that would be able to preserve and lubricate weaponry in especially the tropical regions where increasingly imperial troops were being deployed. It's very easy for European-made guns to jam or to rust or to otherwise have problems in those theaters of imperial warfare. So I don't have hard evidence that palm oil was ever used precisely for that, but certainly the European hunger and for different types of oils and experimentation with oils was very much driven by the needs of the military. There are many other, though, weaponized uses of palm oil in the late 19th and early 20th century. One of them is, as I mentioned, the way it could grease the wheels of things like steamships. And it's difficult to underestimate the military importance of steamships that could force their way up rivers. I mean, probably the most famously in the first Opium Wars, it was used to open up the then port of Canton. But in many other theaters as well, including the invasion of the Benin Kingdom that's so central to the story that I'm telling. Beyond that, though, palm oil was a very cheap source of glycerin, and glycerin is one of the most important components, or one of the key components, of dynamite, as sort of developed by Alfred Nobel and his factory in Hamburg. When mixed with explosives, it can create a very potent and stable explosive. And so really the history of warfare in the 20th century has the shadow of palm oil cast over it. And not only in the sense that, you know, dynamite was used for aerial bombardment and, you know, bombings, but also in the sense that of the kind of weaponization of infrastructure as well. Palm oil was essential to, of course, the greasing of locomotives and railways that could cut into the interior and allow the extraction of resources and the movement of troops into the interior of colonized countries and territories. But dynamite could also be used to blast through rock to and level ground in order to allow those railway tracks to be laid as well. And later on, highways and other forms of infrastructure. It also permitted the blasting deeper of mines and, of course, at huge expense, as many people who were rendered disposable by the system were killed in laying or in laying those explosives or were caught up in those explosives as well. And then in the Second World War, as you alluded to, napalm became part of the weapon that still bears its name, which is napalm, which was developed at Harvard Laboratory as a weapon of war in the Second World War. By sort of the later part of the 20th century, it was used extensively in counterinsurgency warfare, specifically against colonized people who were waging wars of national liberation or seeking to liberate themselves from the structures of colonial or neocolonial capitalism. And napalm become sort of synonymous with the kind of counterinsurgent warfare that not only targeted combatants, but also civilians and ecosystems. And that kind of triangular relationship between insurgents, ecosystems, and people. Now, by the time of the Vietnam War, where napalm became, of course, very famous and that led to very important boycotts of companies like DuPont in the United States, by that time, palm oil was no longer being used in napalm production. They had replaced it with a plastic derivative, but the name still bears the trace. And ultimately, my book is an attempt to sort of pull all of these threads and these traces to kind of generate a larger picture of palm oil's influence over the world that we all share.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And speaking of war, even the war between Ukraine and Russia is also exacerbating the situation. It might be increasing the demand for palm oil. Does it play any role in that?
Yeah, I mean, at the very beginning of that conflict in 2022, there was a massive spike in the price of food oils around the world, including palm oil, because between them, Russia and Ukraine produce about 80% of the world's sunflower oil. So as markets got spooked by the war and worried that sunflower oil wouldn't reach market, or it would reach market at a much higher price or not in the quantities that were needed, there was a kind of speculative rush to leap on other competitor oils, including palm oil. And that drove up the cost of palm oil quite considerably, with a number of different very dangerous consequences. I mean, for people who depend on palm oil for nutrition, which is a considerable percentage of the world's poorest people, as it is one of the world's cheapest oils. It meant that one of the staples of their diet was now put increasingly out of reach. But it also raised fears, especially among environmentalists, that there would be a repeat of what happened in the early 2000s when the EU and the United States demanded that a certain percentage of petroleum products be derived from biofuels. And this policy, which was intended to help stave off climate change, actually led to one of the most destructive knock-on effects in the history of climate change recently. The rising cost of biofuels meant that it incentivized essentially both governments, entrepreneurs, agribusiness, and also organized crime to start slicing down huge swaths of tropical rainforests to plant palm oil plantations in order to generate biofuels. So there was a concern that the war in Ukraine would also lead to jack up the price of palm oil and lead to that kind of response from markets to exacerbate ecological destruction. But the jury's still out on if that'll happen, and the price of palm oil has more or less stabilized. But it just, I think, goes to show how global markets in this age of sort of decentralized capitalist empire that we live in have these often catastrophic effects where some sort of volatility in one part of the world can lead to, you know, the destruction of millions of acres of rainforest in another part of the world.
And let's talk about commodity fetishism and how it disguises the harmful effects of palm oil. You did talk about, you alluded to that at the beginning of the interview, that there are products that are marketed as being eco-friendly, but as a matter of fact, they aren't, and it could be traced back somehow to, I mean, parallels of that could be traced back to the marketing of soap, for example, as an ethical choice. Can you talk about that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's sort of two types of commodity fetishism here, and we could speak about like maybe what Marxists might call like a vulgar commodity fetishism on one hand, and then a more theoretically rich notion of commodity fetishism as well. On the one hand, you have what we might call from a theoretical perspective, vulgar commodity fetishism, which is the way that we become attached to certain commodities and how those commodities, we use our purchasing of certain commodities as a kind of proxy for our form of self-expression. We express ourselves through our commodity purchases. And so over the last 15 years especially, there's been a huge rush into sort of greenwashed products, including from the palm oil industry, that advertise themselves as eco-friendly, as sustainable, as good for the earth, as the right choice for a thoughtful, ethical consumer. And this has been especially the case with palm oil because, for various reasons we might be able to get into a little bit later in our discussion, the palm oil industry has come under quite specific and quite unique scrutiny in world markets, especially in Europe, but also in North America and other, you know, colonizing countries or countries that are the beneficiaries of our neocolonial world system. As a result, often many of the products that you might see in a grocery store that advertise themselves as eco-friendly are actually palm oil products. This is partly thanks to an industry group or a roundtable with industry, government, and some environmental NGOs called the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, which certifies certain palm oil products as sustainable. And then that's used by companies, including Unilever, who was mentioned earlier, which is still one of the world's largest users of palm oil as a way to sell products to eco-conscious consumers. And as the climate crisis gets worse and people are more and more afraid of the consequences and want more and more in a genuine way, I think, to be able to do something, those consumer choices become more and more appealing. And this is part of the argument of the book, is that to the extent that we cede to capitalism the idea that our political and social agency is limited to consumer choices, we're increasingly beholden to these you know, essentially lies from the industry that insist to us that, you know, we should buy their product and therefore help save the earth. Now, that's the sort of more vulgar commodity fetishism that kind of I'm exploring in the book. The deeper type of commodity fetishism really takes up that term again from Karl Marx, to look at the way that every time we buy a commodity and we're engaging in a kind of process of forgetting, we forget that that commodity is the product of human labor. In this case, and I think this is something Marx didn't speak about enough, although there are many Marxists recently have opened up our eyes to how you could think about it this way, it's a collaboration between human labor and non-human labor as well. In this case, a collaboration between humans and a very particular plant, the oil palm. Ultimately, what this kind of deeper notion of commodity fetishism would force us to contend with is that palm oil is the product of the same system that entraps and has created each of us. And in Tausig's book on palm oil, he makes the very important point that we are all essentially now, as a global species, made partly of palm oil. I mean, almost all of us have at some point metabolized palm oil to reproduce our body. We've used it on our skin. We use it in our homes. It is part of us. We are part of the world that palm oil built. And palm oil is the result of the world that we, as an interconnected global species, have built. The deeper kind of notion of commodity fetishism is that we forget this in buying the product that's labeled as sustainable. We forget our place within a global system of capitalism that fundamentally shapes how we cooperate as a global species and also how we cooperate with other species. And that, I mean, my book is not intended to be a particularly hopeful or optimistic book, but what optimism is in there is that perhaps through writing and thinking together and learning together, we can do a kind of remembering that that reverses commodity fetishism in some way and allows us to perhaps better imagine forms of solidarity that might move us towards more peaceful and sustainable futures.
I wanted to ask you about these two notions, notions of forgetting and sacrifices that you talk about in the book, and you just talked about forgetting. The thing is that you're right. Many of us consume palm oil, and we only think of the environmental impacts, but there's another layer of that as well, because in the consumption of palm oil, there's also the forced acquisition of land, the customary land rights of the indigenous people have been seized by force by the palm oil industry. So maybe it's also a chance to talk about the entanglement. It's not easy to get rid of palm oil, as you mentioned. It's a very complicated process. It has become us. And maybe it's a good time to talk about the entanglement of palm oil and cheap labor and how it affects also the indigenous communities where palm oil comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, palm oil only grows in tropical zones. And while it was originally extracted primarily from West Africa in the 19th century, by the end of that century, it had begun to move around the world thanks to European imperialism. So the Dutch brought it to Indonesia, the English brought it to what's now Malaysia. It was imported in quantity to Latin America. And in all of these tropical regions, the oil palm thrived in damaged landscapes. Now, that's partly because of its kind of ecological niche. It grows quite well, especially in burned landscapes. But we can also take that metaphorically as well. It's not coincidental that Indonesia and Malaysia, countries like Colombia or Honduras, are all countries that have seen horrific forms of colonial or neo-colonial violence. And this violence has not only detached people from their land base, it's also created massive pools of migrant labor. And that has been really central to the history of the palm oil industry, because oil palms are difficult to cultivate, and the cultivation and even the refining of palm oil, or at least in its initial stages, is very difficult to automate. So it requires a fair amount of human labor. And that is rendered cheap if you have populations who've been detached from their means of subsistence, who no longer have the means to feed themselves, who have been severed from their land base. As the palm oil industry has expanded, thanks to global demand for the product, it's encouraged governments, but not only governments, also companies and organized crime syndicates to expand further and further into the hinterland, taking land from indigenous people or from peasants in those hinterlands. Often the line in many of these places between government, companies, and organized crime is essentially immaterial. I mean, they're the same actors, or they're working in concert. And as a result, what we've seen over the last decades is palm oil as a kind of weapon against indigenous people and against sustainable livelihoods that has the effect not only of seizing the land, but also rendering our populations as disposable, as sacrificial, and as cheapened, as sources of cheapened labor as well.
And talking about the impacts of palm oil industry on the indigenous communities, is one justification that sometimes is used by big corporate is that it's true that it's doing some damage to the environment, but it's also providing the indigenous communities with the means of sustenance and it providing them with some income. So have indigenous communities ever benefited from palm oil industry?
Some indigenous people have benefited from the palm oil industry, and some West Africans benefited from the palm oil industry in the 19th century, and indigenous people around the world, some benefit from massive extraction projects. There's a question about like if the fact that a few indigenous people make money and can now participate on some level in a global economy is what's in the interests of indigenous people generally, either within their particular communities or more broadly as a category. I think generally all capitalist industries that are destructive in this way have always, since the 18th century or the 17th century, but certainly in the 19th and the 20th century, claimed that, you know, they're giving people jobs. But the question is, is that what indigenous people wanted, or did they want their land? And why now do they need jobs? They need jobs in order to earn wages. They need wages in order to buy products that they can no longer produce for themselves through their relationship with the land. So ultimately, what we're seeing here is a process of coercive transformation that indigenous people, in the vast majority of cases, never got to choose, or were only able to choose under, conditions of incredible pressure. And now, you know, as the right hand has crushed whole lifeways and committed what can only be described on a global scale as massive, multidimensional genocide, then the left hand of the sort of corporate capitalist empire offers a pittance of wages in return. The vast majority of the time, with the exception of some indigenous elites, those wages are only enough to keep people alive from day to day, rather than allowing them to reclaim some sort of autonomy within their communities or ecosystems. And the ecosystems, in many cases, are fundamentally and forever changed.
I guess you're right. And as you mentioned, it's mainly with indigenous, it's mainly the elites or the politicians. I guess it's even the case in Indonesia who have benefited from the industry, but the vast majority of other people have really been at loss. And I know it's a kind of difficult question to answer, but what is the solution? What can we as consumers do? Or is there anything that we as consumers do? Because I'm aware that right now that I'm speaking to you, I'm drinking water out of a recycled bottle, but that might be palm oil. I'm taking notes as you're speaking. I'm just enmeshed. It has become a part of me. What is the way out? Or what is it that we as individuals can do?
I mean, unfortunately, I don't think there's much we as individuals can do. And part of the argument of the book is that palm oil now presents itself as one of many global problems we face as a species. It's a very unique species on the face of the earth. We as humans have fundamentally transformed the planet for our benefit, but for the benefit of a very, very small percentage of us. And we've done so through a system of capitalism that makes it very hard to make collective decisions outside of purchasing. But the irony is that the more we fall into the trap of thinking that our only power is through commodity actions, through buying and selling, we cede our imagination and we cede our collective power to the very system that's creating the destruction in the first place, which is to say this kind of neo-colonial global capitalism we're a part of. So in the book, I'm quite skeptical towards individualist solutions, although I certainly understand why they would be attractive to our imaginations. I think, you know, we are a storytelling species and we tend to tell our stories about the actions of individuals and their consequences. And so our imaginations always gravitate towards that. But I think what we desperately need are forms of anti-capitalist storytelling that allow us to recognize a different we, a different us, a different kind of agency that allow us to come to grips with what it means to be a global species that has to make very difficult choices. And so with that in mind, that's sort of my first answer to this very complex question. The second answer to this very complex question is, I think wherever we begin, we need to start with the voices and the knowledge and the desires of the most affected people. And in the end of my book, and in every interview I do, I try and give a shout out to the Transnational Palm Oil Labor Solidarity Network, which is a really wonderful group of activists, journalists, researchers, indigenous groups, really focused on how palm oil laborers and workers affected by the palm oil sector can stand together and make demands. And last year, they developed a really fascinating blueprint for a just transition within the industry. And what was suggested in that blueprint is to give the land back to the people who are affected by palm oil plantations and the palm oil industry, and let them begin and support them to develop sustainable frameworks for land use that might work with indigenous forms of knowledge and also be integrated into a much more humane global economy, a global economy built on notions of solidarity rather than notions of exploitation. In that report, they sort of suggest that displaced workers, if they had the land, could resettle. Indigenous people, if they had the land, could reimagine what the relationship to land would be. And maybe oil, excuse me, sorry. And maybe oil palms would be one part of a diverse sort of set of land uses. And maybe the export of some palm oil would be a part of the way that those communities would opt to use the land. I mean, as we were talking about at the beginning of this discussion, the oil palm has been cultivated by West Africans for millennia and has many, many, many purposes and uses. And there are many elements of palm oil, perhaps not refined, bleached, deodorized palm oil, but virgin palm oil, that can be very useful in a variety of products. So in this case, perhaps the oil palm would remain as one among many different kinds of non-human species that humans might collaborate with, but certainly not on the level of sort of industrial, ecocidal production that defines the industry today. Now, this is the third part of this answer. If that were to happen, and it will take a huge amount of global solidarity for that to happen, consumers in the global north and countries that tend to import palm oil would need to look elsewhere for either edible oil products or some substance that could do the work that palm oil does in so many of the products I listed earlier, that 50% of supermarket products, as well as products that are used in industrial manufacturing and many other applications. You know, for indigenous people and workers to be able to reclaim the lands that palm oil plantations are would require incredible magnitude of global solidarity. It would require that all of us recognize that we are all being forced to work within a system that is killing us and killing the planet. And it would require that we be able to bring to bear on a global scale incredible amounts of pressure, not only on particular companies like, say, Unilever, to do this or that, or be sustainable or not sustainable in their product manufacturing and sourcing. It would require really the seizure of social wealth by the global working class. And I think that's a very important goal. you know, I don't think there's a solution to the palm oil problem in some ways that doesn't begin with us recognizing that all of us, not just people who are living on palm oil plantations, all of us have been stripped from our means of subsisting and living in good relation to the earth. So part of what we need is a change in our focus away from sort of consumer activism and towards recognizing that, you know, again, that kind of deeper notion of commodity fetishism, that beyond each palm oil commodity is not only the incredible violence that has created the system, but the incredible potential of our species to cooperate differently and for us to reclaim the means of living together and living with other species. But that would also mean for those of us who are in palm oil consuming countries that we need to relocalize a lot of production of, for instance, oils. You know, in India, palm oil is quickly becoming the most popular cooking oil. And it's especially, as I put it in the book, the fat of the world's poor. It's the fat of consumers who can afford nothing else because they're too poor to afford other kinds of oil. It's also the fat of people who've been displaced from their lands and can no longer produce the oil, the edible oil, which is an important part of human diets that their ancestors produced. And so it would require all of us rethinking how we could come into greater communion with the land where we're situated and produce many, not all, but many of the things we need locally in sustainable, you know, permaculture style fashions. Now, that would mean in very practical terms that the kind of purchasing power that people in the neocolonial countries or countries that benefit from neocolonialism have become used to, we would have to give up a lot of what we now consider to be luxuries. But that in some ways is perhaps a small price to pay for what's on the other side of it, which is a new form of communion with other humans and the more than human world. And in some way, a way of, at least on the horizon, being able to imagine an ethical relationship with the earth and other humans.
Max, thank you very much for this conversation. But before we end the interview, is there any other project or monograph you're currently working on?
I'm working on many ideas right now, but I've taken a little bit of a break. Right now, I'm working very hard on developing a board games lab, as I was mentioning at the beginning, where we're trying to create a board and card games to teach topics of globalization, social justice, decolonization, and the radical imagination. I'm also perennially fascinated with and writing a book on scams and the role of scams in capitalism.
Thank you very much. I absolutely enjoyed this conversation. I strongly recommend our listeners to pick up the book. It's an easy book to read, not too long, and it's very, very informative. Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you so much.